Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's summertime and the living may be easier because of vacations. It is anything but easy, however, peaceful or relaxing for politics. Politics is in full swing, in overdrive, in fact. So far this summer, we've had a Supreme Court decision on political gerrymandering. Candidate filings have begun for our local elections this fall. The 9th District race continues on its drive to September's special election. The state budget, well, that's a whole topic unto itself. Mecklenburg County residents face a possible sales tax hike, and the Trump administration continues its efforts to do an end run around the high court in its attempt to put a citizenship question on the 2020 census. In short, a lot is going on, and because you may not be paying close attention while you're on your summer holiday, we'll catch you up this hour. We're joined by several political observers. Michael Bitzer is professor of political science at Catawba College. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Jim Moore is a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hello to you.
Thank you.
And Steve Harrison is our political reporter here at WFAE News. Good morning.
Hey, Mike.
And Loretta Beniti is a political reporter for Spectrum News and for their In Focus program. And she joins us, I think, in the environs of Jones Street this morning. Is that correct?
That's right. I'm right in the thick of it.
Well, good morning to you. Last night was a night for the history books. the legislature was to have voted up or down on the budget, which the governor has vetoed, and they didn't do it. What happened?
Well, all day we were talking to the leadership here at the legislature to find out whether or not they were actually going to take that vote. Just because it appears on the calendar these days does not necessarily mean that they're going to do it. And essentially the answer we kept getting all day is, we simply don't know until we do a head count of how many people are sitting in that chamber on Monday evening, because they need to get 7 Democrats to join onto their side in order to be able to override this veto. They did not have that number on the original vote for the budget. Now, if you talk to Republican leaders, they say they have picked up votes. They know that they would come close, if not actually reach that threshold. If you talk to Democratic leaders, they say they actually might have lost some votes.
How many Democrats voted for the original budget before the governor vetoed
it? I believe that it was 3 or 4. It was hard. It was a different number between the first vote and the second vote.
And as I understand it, those 3 or 4 Democrats were offered what essentially are tens of millions of dollars in what they call earmarks, which we call pork, for their districts in order to convince them to vote for the budget. Was it just those Democrats, or did they pick up more Democrats in the Republicans' eyes because of the earmarks offered to them?
I think you can certainly look at what was built into the budget for the Cumberland County area and wonder about the entire Cumberland County delegation, which is Democrats, if there are some that now feel as though I can't not take this money back to my district, or at least vote for this budget. So there were strategic earmarks put in there, even if they didn't have the votes at that point. And keep in mind, after whatever budget is passed there's another thing called the Budget Technical Corrections Bill that comes out right before they go home. So if there's some Democrats that are on the fence, they can also put more earmarks for them into the budget technical corrections bill as a way to get them over the fence.
Well, Phil Berger, the Senate majority leader, as you well know, was kind of playing hardball, at least on Twitter last night. He said Governor Cooper complained in his budget press conference about specific priorities that individual legislators requested as part of the negotiation process. He's talking about pork now. If a veto override fails, we will agree to start with a blank slate. They're all off the table. If legislators choose to block priorities for their own districts because of loyalty to the governor, they can explain why to their constituents. Them's fighting words, aren't they?
They are. It, you know, a lot of us here in the press corps always say there has to be that one moment, it feels like, in every session where it's we see the straw that breaks the camel's back, and then they start to move forward on negotiation process, it almost feels like this might be it. That the governor's holding a press conference at 10 o'clock today. He's going to be laying out his new suggestions for the budget during that time. But meanwhile, it's starting to look less and less likely like this veto override will happen. And Phil Berger definitely made it clear last night, if we start over, we're starting over on what we're putting into this budget.
Yeah, the press conference is set for 10 o'clock, and the governor invited the legislative leaders to his office to meet at 8 o'clock this morning on, I guess, what he's going to preview, what he's going to say in his press conference. What do you know about that meeting?
I know that the Republican, my understanding is the Republican leaders did not go to that meeting today.
They obstructive. Were
they were not happy with it. I was at the legislature last night. A session was going on. It got out fairly late last evening. And I will tell you that Speaker Moore and Senator Berger did not find out about the invitation until after session was over. I saw, each one of them being told that the invitation had come in. So it was a very late invitation to come over at 8 a.m. this morning.
And Senator Berger said the time for Governor Cooper to talk about the budget was a month ago when I personally, this is a quote, when I personally handed him my opening offers on his top priorities and asked him for a counteroffer. He refused to give one and instead blocked teacher and state employee raises, rape kit testing, and school construction funding over his Medicaid ultimatum. Is that true? Is all of that true?
Yeah, there was a meeting about a month ago where Senator Berger and Speaker Moore went over and met with the governor. They brought a binder with them. We didn't ask them to open the binder and see what he had inside. Could have been blank paper, but we're guessing that he did put some priorities in there and did ask the governor to respond to it. But the governor has been firm since the beginning of this process that until the actual negotiation on Medicaid begins, he is not going to accept anything to do with this budget.
Some Democrats, as we have already said, voted in favor of this and may have voted had there been a veto override vote because of pork legislation that was put in this measure. They might have voted for that to help their districts. But others, including Senator Ben Clark of Hoke County, voted against the budget despite the earmarks because he said, "We ran and were elected on the promise of better health care, better jobs, and better schools. We can do better than this." And the sticking point here is Medicaid and the expansion of Medicaid, which has been a Democratic priority since the beginning of the Affordable Care Act. Republicans, since the McCrory administration, have been against expanding Medicaid. Governor McCrory used to say it's because our Medicaid system is woefully broken and we don't know what an expansion will cost us until we get a handle on our broken Medicaid system. Has that been fixed? What is the objection to expanding it now? In light of the fact that Republicans now know that people like the Affordable Care Act.
Right. So Here's what's interesting. While we're still waiting to find out what's happening with the budget, as we're speaking right now, there's a House Health Committee that is meeting. One of the bills they're taking up is called the North Carolina Health Care for Working Families Act. A lot of people who pay attention to politics know this better as Carolina Cares. Mm-hmm. This is kind of Medicaid expansion light, and this is something that more than likely we will see get passed out of the state house this week because the house is willing to do some sort of Medicaid expansion. Not what the Democrats want to see, not what the governor wants to see, but it is a type of expansion of Medicaid. The question is whether or not the Senate will even consider something like this. I'm sure there's a lot of negotiating, a lot of horse trading going on right now to see if this bill could be the magic bullet in order to get them over this hurdle.
So this bill, House Bill 655, which is called North Carolina Health Care for Working Families, and it's referred to commonly as Carolina Cares, the publicly available version of the bill would cover residents who meet all federal Medicaid citizenship and immigration requirements and are not eligible for Medicaid under the current program. So how does this, you called it Medicaid Lite, how does this differ from the current Medicaid expansion proposals?
It has more parameters around it. It uses the state's Medicaid program to offer this insurance, but there are more restrictions than what you see on the current Medicaid program.
Because House Speaker Tim Moore said that this bill has work requirements and things that protect the taxpayer. What kinds of protections are there? We're just not giving money away to people who don't need it? Is that what he's referring to?
Well, yes. That whole work requirement is a really big deal for a lot of the Republicans when they're looking at what they want to be willing to offer. In all honesty, because I'm not at this 9 o'clock meeting, I have not seen what the most recent version of the bill is. I believe that they were building in more quote-unquote safety net things into the bill in their effort to get more Republicans to vote for it, because I think that the House believes that they need to get this bill passed in order to get the budget passed.
So you have your ear to the ground in Raleigh. What do you think is going to happen today, and what do you think ultimately will happen with this budget? And if it gets vetoed, if they can't override the veto, what happens then? The state doesn't shut down like the federal government. What happens then?
Well, we can continue where we are for some time because everybody's getting paid. The core functions are still getting the money that they were getting last year. The problem is the things that get the non-recurring money, they're not getting money right now. I think what will happen if the state is unable to override the veto, is we're going to see something that looks like a budget technical corrections bill get passed. And that's going to be something that has that one-time money put into it for things. There's several programs within the Department of Health and Human Services that need money. There's money that's needed towards this Medicaid switchover that the state is in the process of doing. We have to implement the Raise the Age law. These are all expenditures that were not in last year's budget that pretty much everybody can agree we need that money right now. So I think we'll see something that looks like a budget technical corrections bill that just deals with those very specific things.
Do you see any kind of compromise in the offing that would cause a budget bill to actually be passed and signed?
I think it will be very interesting to see what happens with this this bill that is moving today over on the House side. Right now, I don't see the Senate being willing to even consider this bill because they have been so adamant about no Medicaid expansion. But there are things that the Senate wants that I'm sure that there's discussion. Okay, we've been saying no for years to you on things like certificate of need for hospitals, and that if perhaps the House would consider that, maybe the Senate would consider the Medicaid. I think this is all going to be worked out within the legislature itself and what they're willing to do, and then they'll bring the governor on board to see if they'll sign this budget.
Loretta Beniti is the political reporter for Spectrum News and for their In Focus program. Thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Michael Bitzer is here from Catawba College, along with Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. I'm just curious as to how this might play out, whether the budget gets passed, whether it's vetoed, whether this stumbling block of Medicaid stays on the books. We're facing an election, and it's an election in which Democrats want more seats in the legislature, and the Republicans want to get back the seats they lost so they can get their supermajority back. How might this play into politics going forward?
I think it plays into everybody's corner. The question is, who's going to blink first? This is basically a money chicken game in terms of who's going to blink, who's going to give, and how do they come to some resolution in a new era of divided government. Remember, this is the first real experience that North Carolina has had with this very tightly controlled legislature with the governor. The dynamics between Democrats and Republicans are being basically played out in this budget battle.
Okay, when we come back, we talk about local politics, we talk about Tom Tillis in the Senate race, we talk about there's an election today. We'll talk about that as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about our political summer. Of course, it's politics all the time, it seems, in America today. But we're here with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Jim Morrill from The Observer, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Let's move to local politics. All seems to be fairly quiet in the Charlotte mayor's race. Candidate filings have begun. Democrat incumbent Vi Lyles has no Republican challenger, but surprisingly, she has a Democratic challenger, a 20-year-old named Joel Odom. He won't turn 21 until a month before Election Day. That's the minimum age you can be to be the Charlotte mayor. His odds seem long. Why did he file,
Jim? You know, this is a time of the year when hope springs eternal for a lot of candidates, and I would think he might be one. You know, he's a community activist. Talked to him briefly at the start of filing last week, and he wants to get involved. And he had several followers there, several supporters there.
Why mayor? Why begin there?
That's probably a good question. A lot of people would start at a city council district level, or it's in the city council at least. But he decided to go for the top.
Because he said that he's tired of seeing so many young people dying on the streets. Is he referring to the opioid crisis or something else? The gun crisis? What's he referring to there?
It really wasn't clear. I mean, we've seen a record number of homicides this year, or at least a high number of homicides. So it could be any of those things.
His last name is Odom. That's a famous name in North Carolina politics. Is he related to Fountain Odom?
I don't think so.
Okay. It is difficult to beat an incumbent, although Vi Lyles beat a Democrat 2 years ago or a year and a half ago when she beat incumbent Mayor Jennifer Roberts. Same dynamics at play this time, or is there something very different
here? No, I mean, that was a pretty cataclysmic election. There was a lot that preceded that with HB2 and the riots and the street after the police shooting, and I don't think we've had that. I think the most controversial issue for Mayor Lyles could be the Republican convention. To your point about Mr. Odom, he didn't mention that at all deciding to run.
And the Republican convention and its presence here and the mayor's role in attracting it to come to Charlotte when it apparently no other city wanted it, is that playing a role in the fact that there are no Republican challengers as yet who have come forward?
Yeah, I think it is definitely. You know, I think a lot of Republicans think well of the mayor for her support of the convention. And it's like Kenny Smith, who ran last time and ran a pretty serious campaign just a couple of years ago, said that if you're going to run a serious campaign as a Republican, you have to start early. And you would have had to start raising money, you know, at the beginning of the year at least. This is going to be could be a race of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So.
And I think that's correct. I think that the mayor has a lot of goodwill with Republicans. But I think there's also something going on. I mean, I don't think they have a candidate. And let's look at city council at large. There are four seats. The Republicans have not won one in 10 years. But they, in every election, they have put forth a few candidates that have run serious races. I think this time there may be zero. I mean, we don't know that for sure.
Right.
I think this may be a real tipping point election in that the Republican Party, we will see, but they may not run a serious city race for the first time in forever.
Is that because they've become a rural party and not an urban party?
It's because of that dynamic. I think that the Republican Party, particularly in North Carolina, is much more based in the suburbs and in rural North Carolina. And when you've got the Republican Party third in voter registration in this city, and when the county itself goes basically 60-40 Democratic in presidential elections, it is just not the environment for a Republican, no matter how moderate that Republican is.
And yet, Mayor Vi Lyles' popularity stands at 51%. That is to say, 51% of Charlotte voters approve of her job so far. 30% do not. And that approval seems low enough to provoke a challenge.
Not really.
Really?
I think 51% of all the people at this point is not bad.
It's a majority. And a lot of people can't say that in today's political environment.
Okay. All right.
And she doesn't, and the 30% is pretty low, I think, and the other 20% are people who don't pay attention. So I think she's in pretty good shape, actually.
Charlotte races, mayor races in recent years have been pretty expensive affairs. Is it safe to say this is going to be a really cheap one?
probably.
Inexpensive one. Let me rephrase that.
Buck the trend.
When is it too late for other people to come forward and file for mayor or for city council or for any of these local
Well, the deadline is a week from Friday, okay. So it's a two-week filing period. And, you know, typically you see a lot of hoopla on the first day and on the last day, so there may be some people who come in. But, you know, a lot of the incumbents, I think, are going to kind of quietly file during the 2 weeks.
And I think it's interesting. I mean, going back to what we talked about with the RNC, back a year ago when the city took that big vote on it, there was a lot of people were really upset. And if you went out to places like Plaza Midwood, you'd see those stickers on light poles, you know, like impeach Lyles. I'm not saying there was a huge amount of thought behind that, but it was out there, right? You would see these bumper stickers and stickers. That seems to have really faded away.
And were those stickers provoked, that sentiment provoked by the impending arrival of the RNC next?
Oh, yeah.
That's what it's about?
That was it.
There are several city council seats up for grabs as three members opt not to run again, and one is shifting from a district race to an at-large race. Candidates have filed in District 2. Newcomer Jessica Davis is running there. Former State Senator Malcolm Graham has expressed an interest in that seat as well. Has he decided yet? Has he made any announcements yet?
No, he hasn't. I think he's still doing opposition research, as he said.
Three people are running at the moment. This changes hour by hour, it seems. In District 3, the field pretty crowded with Democrats. In District 4 and District 6, Republican Councilman Tarek Bakari will have a Democratic challenger. Republican Ed Driggs will have a primary challenger. All of this will be decided between now and November, but it seems pretty quiet out there on the Western Front. When will things start to heat up?
Well, they're going to heat up pretty soon. I mean, you said November, but the primary is September 10th, and for some of these district races, those are all going to be decided in the Democratic primary on September 10th. So that's only 8 weeks away.
So for the people who have declared running against incumbents or not, what are they running for? What are the issues that they have talked about? Have they talked about any issues or just put their name out there?
Well, so far, I think we haven't heard a lot. I think they've been campaigning, but we haven't really focused on a lot of that. But, you know, they've got to be concerned about the crime rate in Charlotte and the direction of the city overall.
Okay.
I was just going to say, I think one more interesting thing. There's two Republicans have two city council seats in South Charlotte. Of course, the county, all the Republicans lost last year. And so I think it'll be interesting to see whether the Democrats really mount an effort to win District 6 and 7. Those are their two seats. Or whether there's a feeling that, like, well, you know, a little balance is okay. It's not, is this something we really need? I mean, I'll be curious to watch. Because it's doable now. 10 years ago, a Democrat could not win that seat. Yeah, today they can.
There was talk a couple of weeks ago, about Patrick Cannon, former Mayor Patrick Cannon, re-entering politics again. Somebody even suggested that he run again for mayor. He was arrested and hauled out of the office by the FBI and went to prison for accepting bribes while in office. Has that talk died down?
I think so. I mean, Steve, you might have heard more, but I haven't heard any more about it. Patrick Cannon certainly has not reached out to the media to say one way or the other. And again, by this time, if you're going to mount a serious campaign, you should have started already.
And he's, you know, the former mayor has, I think he spoke with, he does his own radio show, of course, but I think he spoke with Eric Spanberg for about 30 seconds. But there has never been a sit-down interview with anyone, kind of, you know, this old, like, these, like, Barbara Walters-style confessional interviews, like, I've wronged, let's now move forward. Never happened. I think he is just, that is in the past. I'm not sure if he really wants to relive all of the scandal.
I wouldn't, but the invitation is open. If he wants to be on the program. Republican Senator Tom Tillis is up for re-election in the fall of 2020, but already he's being challenged in the March 3rd Republican primary, which is still way, way, way far away, by Garland Tucker. He's a chief executive of a Raleigh investment company who says Tillis hasn't done enough to toe the Trump line. and by a guy named a woman named Sandy Smith of Pitt County. You reported that some analysts, Jim, say Tillis is one of the most vulnerable GOP incumbents. Why?
Well, I think part of it is North Carolina, which is a purple state, and you know, it's always been. You know, races are always close here, whether it's a presidential race or the U.S. Senate races, and that's one reason. And Senator Tillis, I don't think is as strong a Republican incumbent as some Republicans would like to be. But when you talk about 2020, he's always mentioned in a group with Arizona and Colorado.
Yeah.
Is one of the most vulnerable incumbents.
So when you talk about vulnerability, you're talking about his chances against a Democrat, or could that extend to his chances against a Republican challenger in the primary?
I think mostly as a Democrat, okay. Against a Democrat, but also against I think Garland Tucker would be a strong candidate. He's already put $1 million into his campaign. There's a lot of Republicans out there who don't think that Senator Tillis has been steadfast enough in support for the president.
I haven't seen any polls for Garland Tucker, but there's one poll, an Emerson College poll, that showed Sandy Smith leading Tillis 46-39%. Go ahead.
I would be questioning that particular poll simply because I think the name recognition of Tillis is much higher than what that poll is granting.
Okay.
And the fact that the battle seems to be between Tillis and Tucker as to who supports Trump the most. And President Trump came out and gave his full endorsement
to Tillis.
So if the argument is you are not supportive enough of the president, Tillis can respond with, well, he endorses me, so I must be doing something well.
Will that diffuse or neuter the campaign?
I think it would. If it was becoming a battle of who is more a Trump Republican, when the president weighs in, I think that question goes off the table, and that, you know, the real question becomes now, as Jim said, the state is so politically divided evenly. Tillis won this race, I think, 1.5% over Kay Hagan 5 years ago now. So it's going to be another real battle in this state.
I was going to say, were you all surprised the president's endorsement came so quickly? I mean, I talked to some Republicans who thought that the president might kind of let Tillis, would ultimately endorse him,
right,
but might let him twist for a little bit. I mean, because he's challenged him in the past, and it seemed to come.
Yeah, he wrote that op-ed.
Sure, the op-ed on the emergency declaration.
And changed his decision on that. I think what Trump is looking at is they've got to keep the Senate, if at all possible. And this is one of the critical seats in order to keep that Senate. So, you know, Trump likes to play games, but I think he recognizes probably with Mitch McConnell's, you know, endorsement of we've got to keep who we have now and not open it up to any surprises.
And I think the Republican primary is going to force Senator Tillis to spend money that he probably didn't expect to have to spend,
right,
because Garland Tucker is going to spend money.
There's also a Democratic primary in that race, obviously. The former chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission, Trevor Fuller, says he's running. He announced his candidacy, as have Cal Cunningham, who seems to be the front runner, Erica Smith, and Eric Mansfield, I'm told, just dropped out, and Eva Lee, who announced her intentions way back in 2017. Who is she?
She's from Raleigh, and I don't know if she's still in the race or not, to be honest with you.
Why did Eric Mansfield decide now's the time to get out? Hasn't even started yet.
You know, that's curious, because he just came into the race a few days before that with a pretty slick video. He's a doctor. He's a former senator. He's African-American. He had a good story to tell.
And he's a minister.
And he's a minister on top of that.
And a military veteran.
That's right. I think he was in Iraq, actually.
Punches all the buttons.
He does. And so he seemed to have a lot going for him. And in his announcement that he wasn't going to run, he just said that there was a lot. He realized he had a lot to do with all these jobs and being a doctor. And he looked at all the money he would have to raise in a Senate primary.
Cal Cunningham also... trying to think. He's an Afghanistan and Iraq veteran. He's a former state senator from Lexington. He's run for lieutenant governor in the past and lost, and ran for a U.S. Did he run US for U.S. Senate in 2010? Vice chairman of the Governor's Crime Commission. pretty heavy resume. Is that why he's apparently the front runner at the moment?
Well, I think the Democratic Senate committee and Senator Schumer in Washington were looking for a strong candidate to run, because I think Democrats, to follow up on what Dr. Bitzer said, Democrats feel like they have to win North Carolina in order to win the Senate. And so they were looking for a strong candidate, and they seem to have settled on Cunningham. And whether that's one reason Dr. Mansfield dropped out, I don't know, but it could be.
And he hasn't – I mean, what's interesting, I mean, Mike, you talked about his great resume, which is true, but he hasn't held elected office in – I mean, what – he was in the state legislature
– many moons ago.
Early 2000s. I just think that's interesting that – I mean, I think the Democrats, some of their top choices Josh Stein, Anthony Fox, Jeff Jackson are not in, and so that has moved him.
Well, I was going to ask about that. Is that because the top Democrats are waiting for Richard Burr 2 years from now to come up because he's not going to run for reelection, and that gives them a more even playing field?
I'm going to play contrarian political scientist here and make the argument that if let's say hypothetically Donald Trump loses the presidency and a Democrat wins the White House. Mm-hmm. Typically what midterms tend to turn into is referendums on the president. And that would make 2022 a Republican-leaning year. Why, you know, as opposed to 2020, which is going to be a very competitive coin toss kind of an election year. Okay. You know, if Democrats are eyeing 2022, they have to make sure all the cards are dealt correctly for them in order to have a shot in this state in a midterm election year.
You also have the potential of a crowded field in 2022 because you have former mayor Anthony Fox who may get into a race. You have some of the people that we've mentioned, so it could be people could be lining up on both sides.
If the National Democratic Party has already kind of put their seal of approval on Cal Cunningham, is that the kiss of death for these other candidates? I mean, are they wise to not spend the money and wait?
Well, I don't know that they could raise the money, to be honest with you, because Trevor Fuller has $1,000 in the bank as we speak, according to the latest reports that came out yesterday.
$1,000?
Right. Yeah, $1,100 to be exact.
And I think, you know, the National Democrats are looking at Cal Cunningham as a potentially viable best candidate, but there could be other candidates that decide. It's getting late in the season, but another big name, Deborah Ross, who ran as well.
And of course, Dan McCready.
And Dan McCready.
He keeps getting asked about this because he will know his fate in September, which is if he loses the 9th District race. September is not that far from
the filing period.
So, and he's when he's asked about that by the media, he says, "I am not running for Senate." I think there's a little bit of difference between "I am not going to run." You know, I mean, you could be a little more clear.
And we must stop. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison from WFAE Newsies, our political reporter. Jim Morrill's a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is the off-frequent guest host of this program and a political scientist at Catawba College. Michael, as luck would have it, today, as we speak, is Election Day. There's a special election in the 3rd Congressional District in North Carolina. Where is that?
It's not around here. It is down on the coast. It is the former Walter Jones district, long time, along with his father, serving member of Congress who passed away in February. This is the Republican runoff second primary to determine who goes into the general election.
There were 17 people vying for the seat, and it came down to two Republicans in this race today, Dr. Joan Perry, a pediatrician, against Dr. Greg Murphy, a state representative and urological surgeon.
The battles of the doctors.
Yeah, it's said to be a test case for the Republican Party's ability to attract female candidates, and it's said to have substantial implications across the country. Why?
I think that they are the national Republicans are looking at this as, can we break into the gender gap? Even though it's in the South and typically white Southern women tend to vote overwhelmingly Republican, this is an attempt to at least raise the profile of Republican women who are so few in comparison to the Democratic caucus, particularly in the House, that is full of women led by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House.
So when you say Republicans are trying to find a way to get more female candidates and make inroads with female voters because of that, why then do you have the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus endorsing Dr. Murphy, the guy, in this race? Why?
Because
they're both conservatives, very conservative.
They're both very conservative, but they're attacking each other as if they are, you know, New York liberals. And I think that
what does that mean?
Well, that means that this is, again, a focus on who shows up in these types of primaries, and it is the hardcore, very conservative Republican voter, and they need to know that they're going to send one of their own. And so I think, you know, this attempt, you know, particularly with Mark Meadows coming in from North Carolina and lending his endorsement to Dr. Murphy, is really a test case of what's going on within the Republican Party.
And why did the Freedom Caucus, led by Mark Meadows, decide to endorse Dr. Murphy, the male?
I think Dr. Murphy is a very conservative legislator, and I think this is a case where ideology for Congressman Meadows and his allies trumps more of a gender balance.
Yeah, and said that he would join the Freedom Caucus if elected. So, you know, there's power in numbers.
So this is also the inaugural effort by the WFW Action Fund, the political arm of a group called Winning for Women, to sway a primary election. This is also the first of its kind organization, I'm told, dedicated solely to electing Republican women. They've spent $900,000 so far attacking Dr. Murphy as, quote, a liberal who is out of step with Donald Trump. But wait, he's already promised to join the Freedom Caucus, so clearly that can't be true. Can it?
it's all in how you frame the issue and how you get your voice and actions and words out to an electorate. That's probably realistically 6-7% voter turnout.
And if he's too liberal, what is she?
She has been described by him as basically a Nancy Pelosi clone. So, you know, you've got the dynamics here of
they've run a picture. Extremes. They've run a picture of her with former Congressman Mike McIntyre of that area, and he's a Democrat, but he was a conservative Democrat.
Very conservative.
So they're trying to brand her, as he said, as a liberal Democrat.
Do people believe this?
I think the true diehards, you know, you don't need to convince them of much, and they will believe whatever it is in their political lenses.
So Donald Trump continues to cater to his very conservative base and has not done very much to try to expand his reach beyond that base. In the 3rd Congressional District primary, you have these two very conservative voices competing. Yesterday, The Observer ran an editorial about the biannual public policy mood report, which shows that the annual estimate for 2018 is the most liberal ever recorded in the 67-year history of the report, just slightly higher than the previous high it was set in 1961. If they're right, the country is in a liberal mood, not a conservative mood. Are Republicans making a mistake by not moderating their positions?
Well, this is a national report, but it does have implications in terms of how both parties look at a potential electorate, particularly in the states, and North Carolina being a competitive battleground is going to be one of those. I think it's due also primarily to the generational shift. You know, I hear people continuously, you know, talk about millennials as, you know, these 20-year-olds. Well, guess what? Next year, the oldest millennial will be almost 40 years old. And so this reshaping of the electorate, and they, people under 40, tend to skew much more Democratic than any other generation out there right now.
Did that answer my question? Are they making a mistake by not moderating their positions?
For Republicans, they have a hardcore conservative base, and they believe with all their heart that that's where the country is. The numbers paint a different picture, but, you know, they would point, Donald Trump in particular would say, I won in 2016.
Yeah. Is that because they're in the bubble? They're in the echo chamber of Fox News. Is that real, or is that because a lot of people were very surprised by the election of Donald Trump?
Oh yeah.
And people who in the Fox world were not surprised by the election of Donald Trump. So are they in the bubble, or is everybody else in the bubble?
I guess we'll find out in 2020. But but I think that if the numbers continue to move as they do, Republicans are going to have to figure out, can they continue a hardcore conservative message in an electorate that may not necessarily be receptive to that?
But millennials, as you know, don't vote at the same rate as baby boomers and older voters. So
why not? They're approaching 40. Why not?
Well, he could answer it better than I could, but I think that people just don't feel the buy-in yet. They don't know that politics affects them as much.
How can they not? Where do they live? Do they ever watch television? Do they listen to radio? Do they read newspapers? Do they look at their phones once in a while at the news coming across? How can they be oblivious to this?
I think that they are aware. They're looking at government in a different manner and are not sure that they have necessarily a voice to make a difference. I think, however, 2020 will be, if the right kind of momentum is generated, that increase in millennials and now Gen Zs could be the deciding factor to tip the scales.
And how does Gen Z differ from their predecessors?
Not in terms of comparison to millennials, they're just as democratic as millennials are. I think they look at, and they're just now coming into the electorate.
Well, if millennials are democratic and they don't think their vote counts, how do they explain Donald Trump's election?
I think part of it was that they just didn't show up. I mean, they showed up for Barack Obama, but they didn't show up for Hillary Clinton. Now they may be seeing that consequence. And 2020, maybe with a Democratic presidential candidate that energizes and mobilizes them, could be a new factor.
Okay. And another place, the place where politics affects you is locally. Mm-hmm. And Mecklenburg County commissioners recently voted 7-2 to let voters decide in November on a half-cent sales tax to support the arts, parks, and greenways. It would raise about $50 million a year. There's no sunset on this. Some on the commission believe that this will be soundly defeated by voters. What do you think?
I think one thing that's interesting is, like you mentioned, this is kind of a bundle sales tax, mm-hmm. greenways, arts, and education. There was a bundle sales tax proposal 5 years ago that failed. If you go back long time ago, 2001, the arena vote was a bundle. That was arena arts and a lot of different things. It's interesting. The two transit votes were very clean. 1998, transit sales tax, let's build trains. It passed. There was a repeal that failed, 2007. I just think that's interesting it seems like if you added a lot of different things that everyone likes, that makes it easier to pass, right? But I wonder, if it just makes the ballot, makes it too confusing, makes the messaging confusing. If we have all these different things, what is it really about?
Well, it's not only that. It's that the burden is really on the people that are trying to sell the referendum and sell the Arts and Science Council and the other things, because the ballot is just going to say, are you for or against raising this tax? It's not going to say anything about arts and science. It's not going to say anything about parks. It's not going to say anything about education, which part of the money would go
for. Why? Why is it that way?
Because the legislature, when they gave counties the ability to pass this tax about a decade ago, they mandated that this would be the language.
So that explains why the people in favor of this, and I think the Arts and Science Council are the people producing a series of podcasts to convince you of the need and why you should vote yes on that. But who is likely to download and listen to this series of podcasts except for those who have already thought to themselves, I'm voting for this? The people who are saying, I'm not voting for this, or I don't care about this, or I don't know about this, aren't going to download that podcast. Are they just spitting into the wind?
They're trying to make their case. They base their case a lot on equity. The arts, they have... At the county commission meeting where they voted on this, so many of the speakers talked about what it meant to them to join a Latin dance company or a minority dance company or choral group or something. So they're really trying to sell this on the basis of equity that would help all corners of the county.
So I want to get back to the wording on the ballot, because it's not going to mention, as you say, it's not going to mention the arts, it's not going to mention the parks, it's not going to mention the greenway. It's just going to say raise the sales tax by a half cent. Is that how
quarter
the transit
cent.
Tax or quarter cent? Is that how the transit tax was presented? Is that how the hotel motel tax is presented?
I think transit did say for transit, because it was kind of a special. The legislature gave the city the approval to put it on the ballot. The hotel motel taxes are just levied non-voter referendum. I think they were just done through Raleigh.
So the other thing about this tax, and it's actually more accurate to do it the way they're doing it, by putting no nomenclature on the ballot at all about what it's going for, because it doesn't have to go there. We found that a couple of weeks ago. It's just going to go, the money collected will go into the general fund, and then if the sitting commission wants to put it toward parks and the arts and greenways, they will, and if they don't, they'll put it someplace else. Why would anybody in their right mind vote for something that cannot be dedicated to what they think they're voting for? And why would you do it that way? Why can't it be dedicated? We keep being told that we can't touch the money that's being collected from the hotel motel tax. We can't touch the money being collected for the transit thing. Why is it we can touch the money for the arts and parks and greenways? What's up with that?
How do you really feel about that?
It's insane.
I think that it's because of the way the legislature dealt with this quarter cent tax. They gave the counties the ability to do it, but they didn't want to tie their hands. They didn't want... They don't want to give them the option of having a dedicated tax.
But if it could be locked, could it be locked as a dedicated tax for the arts? Would it, or for parks and greenways too? Would it be more likely to pass, or will this become the pee under the mattress that people say, I'm not doing this?
I think it's going to be hard to pass a tax. I think I think they'll do a good job of campaigning for it, and it depends who comes out and votes.
And this quarter cent, it's been an option for North Carolina counties now for about 10 years. They've had, I don't know the numbers, but they have been successful in other counties. It's not completely impossible to get voters to approve it. So it you can do it, but right, like Jim said, when you just go and do into the booth and...
And is it safe to say that this county commission would be very likely to dedicate the money to the purpose that they're advertising it for? But the county commission can change over time, and that they might change their mind on this, or would they see this as something that really is untouchable?
No, they wouldn't see it as something untouchable. I mean, I think that if it does pass, there would be a continued pressure from the arts community and the Arts and Science Council and people that support that to keep it where it is, okay. To keep the money going where it is.
The state senate has fast-tracked a bill to crack down on absentee ballot fraud in the shadow of the 9th Congressional District scandal. The bill would also restore early voting hours on the final Saturday before elections. It's called Senate Bill 683. Is this bill more about early voting, or is it really about election fraud?
That's a good question. I know there have been other attempts to deal with the absentee ballot issue, I think. But, I think there was a big hunger for Saturday voting. I think a lot of counties wanted to return to Saturday voting.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing coming out of it, because by all accounts, all the research I've done, that day is very much a popular day because folks like to utilize it. The issues with the bill as it is now, and I think there may be some amendments coming this evening in the session, one of them is the information about who requests and who returns absentee by mail ballots will not be released until election day. Others would contend just release that the ballots have been received so that there is public transparency and accountability on that particular issue.
So in the 10 seconds we have left, this bill has been fast-tracked. What does that mean? Is it likely to pass? Is the governor on board to sign it?
It will likely be passed by the Senate, goes to the House. I don't know what the governor's intentions are.
And I would imagine he would want to reinstate Saturday voting.
Yeah.
Okay. You get the last word, Jim Morrill. Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer, longtime political reporter there. Steve Harrison, longtime political reporter there and here for WFAE News. And Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of political science at Catawba College. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.